In 2016, Stan Lee, the man whose name is synonymous with Marvel Comics, the man who created Spider-Man, Iron Man, the Hulk, came to Kansas City for Planet Comic-Con. And before his Q&A, the organizers staged a group picture with Stan Lee and his adoring crowd.
We're gonna fix this thing. You guys need to stand up and cheer. Excelsior!
Excelsior was Stan Lee's life motto. It means ever upward. And the crowd seemed to get that. Stan Lee also got his crowd. He appreciated their excitement, and he joked about his status as a comic book celebrity.
This day is a fraud. I'm going to tell you why. It's supposed to be a big holiday, right? I understand tomorrow the schools will be open. The mailman will still be delivering the mail. I'd like to think for the whole week everything would stop, and all you'd be doing is showing my cameos.
That's when Mayor Sly James asked the comic book icon when in his career he really felt like he'd finally gotten it right.
I've never done anything correctly. I make more mistakes. I just realized I talked about the schools being open tomorrow. Tomorrow is Sunday.
With great power comes great humility. I'm Gina Kaufman, and as you've probably heard, Stan Lee has died. The comic book community in Kansas City is feeling it as a personal loss. He inspired generations of comic book readers and comic book creators. And today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be hearing how the influence of Stan Lee is alive in Kansas City. Call 816-235-2888 if Stan Lee and his creations shaped your life. 816-235-2888. My first guest is Mike DeStacy. He's a designer in his professional life, but his passion is collecting Spider-Man stuff. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Okay, so I see some of your collection on your person right now. You are wearing a t-shirt with sort of like a split image of Spider-Man and Peter Parker.
An iconic view of the man himself.
Yeah, and it looks fairly weathered. Like, you've had this a while, maybe.
Oh, certainly. I have to be careful how much I wash this thing. It's only got so much integrity left.
When I say you collect Spider-Man stuff, can you give a sense of the scale and scope of your collection?
Thousands of comic books. I've been collecting Spider-Man for over a decade now, and that's buying all the new comics that are coming back and trying to fill in the backwards landscape of all the comics that preceded that. There's all kinds of different branches of Spider-Man comics with different creators who've taken the character in different ways, as well as other characters who have taken the mantle of Spider-Man, right?
The mantle of Spider-Man meaning?
The mantle of Spider-Man meaning other characters who exist as Spider-Man, but are not the classic Peter Parker. One of the most confusing things about comic books that makes them a little hard to be accessible for new fans who are used to the movies is that there's a lot of alternate universes and alternate timelines where they've got different characters portraying different heroes.
So the comics themselves are the bulk of your collection, it sounds like, but I am seeing via your t-shirt that it might include other things.
Oh, certainly. So like any comic book nerd, I'm a hoarder of all little memorabilia and pieces, from anything from little promotional cards that I find for the movies coming out, and posters, pins, all kinds of little things I've accumulated over a lot of time.
So you are also in the crowd at that Stan Lee Q&A we just heard, and I understand it was no small sacrifice for you to be there that day.
Oh, I love that this is getting worked in. Yeah, I'll say hi to my boss if he's listening. We had a conference at my job. I do design work, and we'd gotten tickets for me to go to a creative conference. And then after the fact, I found out that Stan Lee was coming to my hometown of Kansas City. And I didn't know if I'd get another chance to meet the man himself. And so I had to have a very hard conversation with my boss about how, hey, I just can't go. And they had to figure out other travel plans and adjust for everybody. I felt terrible about the whole thing.
But so this speaks to how much not just Spider-Man, but Stan Lee, the creator of Spider-Man, means to you, that this is not a hobby per se. This is something deeper.
Certainly. I think a lot of the characters he's created have transcended your typical pop cultural medium, right? Like there's a whole universe and mythos surrounding what he's created that's not only been a big part of my childhood, but also a huge part of my adulthood. So
tell me about those two different things, his role in your childhood and then his role in your adulthood.
Sure. So I think growing up, the characters that he created have a super interesting dynamic that's unique of other superheroes, that a lot of the characters are flawed or have some interesting personality trait that makes them unique and more identifiable to the audience than, say, an alien that's all-powerful, like a Superman type. For me specifically, Spider-Man was a teenage character who wasn't just a sidekick or an accessory to a larger story. He was a kid who had issues like how to talk to girls and having zits on his face, right? So that's all stuff that, as a kid, I think helped me cope, right? And as an adult, I think you find a lot of interesting, like-minded people who've also explored that realm of fantasy, right? And I've made a lot of connections that way. I think it's shaped, my love of comic books has shaped where my career has gone as a designer, of course. So I can't imagine what my life would be like without comic books.
Why do you think Stan Lee in particular is such a huge figure, and not just in the comics world, but like mainstream American culture? You do not have to be a comic book geek to know Spider-Man. In fact, you would have to be living under a rock not to know Spider-Man.
Right, exactly. And I was having a conversation with a friend the other day about this, that I think for a lot of people, the character Spider-Man is more iconic than, say, the Mona Lisa or these, you know, great works of art that we think transcend time, right? They're huge for us. And his involvement as kind of the face of Marvel and being that go-to that's appeared in all the movies and these little cameos has kind of registered in everybody as like a cool little quirk to make him one of those hyper-present, all-powerful people of comics.
When you say that Spider-Man is more transcendent in some ways than the Mona Lisa, I would imagine that the listeners are probably split in their reaction. That
right.
There are people out there going like, that's blasphemy. And that there are people out there going like, right on, man.
Totally. I think you're right. Now I'm worried about him. I'm going to get some like social media feedback.
No, don't
feedback.
Worry. I would like for the people who find it blasphemous, can you explain where you're coming from?
Oh, totally. Well, I think that when we're looking at modern art and how people interpret those things and appreciate those things, that comic books have more of a story to them, right? And there's a whole thing with the cartoons they've created and how we grew up with these characters consistently in our lives.
Just in a special place in another country.
Right, exactly. They're not necessarily untouchable. We can go to the shop, we can access these things. They teach us morals, they teach us how to relate to other people. So there's an extra depth there, and the characters become so iconic at this point.
Well, now I'd like to introduce Hector Casanova. He's an illustrator of graphic novels. His artwork used to appear in the Kansas City Star. He was actually the artist on staff there. He's lived in Kansas City a long time, but he was born in Mexico, and Spider-Man kind of taught him English. Is that right, Hector?
Yes, English, and in general, it's the first books that I ever read cover to cover were comic books. So it developed my interest in reading in general and drawing.
You know, we just heard about that there's like a moral component to Spider-Man. There's a relatability to Spider-Man. What else did Spider-Man teach you?
I completely agree with what's being discussed already, that there is a vulnerability to Spider-Man that to Peter Parker and to the Marvel superheroes in general, but really Peter Parker was a teenager, which was really relatable to a lot of kids reading comic books. And he was an awkward teenager with social anxiety and money problems and family dynamics that were, you know, really unconventional and trying. You know, he lived with his aunt, who was an elderly lady, so he was taking care of her and felt responsible for her. So he had guilt and responsibility and pressure to do well in school. So he was completely relatable. It was basically a soap opera for kids, which had a good dose of action, fantasy, kind of a superhero stuff happening as well.
Do you think that in the cultural landscape, having that sort of what you called an unconventional model of what a family is maybe was also an important thing?
Yes. I think that that's really kind of a big part of what superheroes kind of represented, was that people that didn't feel like they fit in, that they had a secret identity, that they had a secret life, that they found ways to kind of express themselves and contribute to society and formed unconventional families. You know, another Marvel comic book that I grew up reading was The Fantastic Four, which was also a Stan Lee creation. And that was, you know, very much a group of people that were not all biologically related, but they created this, basically, they had this family, and each one of them had different powers, and some of them were outwardly, you know, very physically grotesque. Like one of them was the Thing, and he looked like a giant rock monster. So each one of them was a freak in a way, and they were uniquely weird, but they kind of came together and created this family of freaks that were a super fantastic team.
Can you talk to me about your relationship with comics more broadly and how that shaped the artist you became?
Sure. I honestly don't think I would be an artist today if I hadn't been reading comic books or and Spider-Man specifically when I was a little kid. Comics got me into reading books in general, but they also introduced me to visual storytelling and to wanting to draw. I used to try to redraw and trace and then just draw from observation panels from comic books when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And then I would make my own comics and I would take the characters and write my own stories. And so the drawing became my babysitter, basically. And my mom knew that if she gave me a stack of paper and some pens and pencils, that I would be safe and taking care of myself for hours at a time. And that eventually evolved into my love for art more broadly and launched me into pursuing art as a career since I was, 8, 9 years old. I knew that that's what I wanted to do.
What do you think about the idea of these stories as having a language of their own? Because you talk about learning English, but I also think of this whole universe as having its own kind of language that's part visual, part code words like Excelsior. You know what I mean?
Yes, and I think that there's kind of two aspects of that. There's the entire comics culture that is its own subculture, and in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, it was very much a niche culture, and it was not the kind of kids and teenagers that grew up reading comics or interested in comics. That's not the kind of thing that you would usually advertise, especially not to the opposite sex. It was very much it was nerd and geek culture. It was not something that it wasn't considered cool by any means for a long, long time. It was kind of something that you would keep on the down low. And over the last 15 years or so, it has completely flipped, and now it has become mainstream and cool. And all of the cool kids are reading comics and watching the superhero movies, where that wasn't the case before. And then the other aspect of it is from the more formal standpoint, the way in which comics and sequential art is its own medium that is completely distinct from the written word and from visual art, but it utilizes elements of both. It has a lot of common ground with cinema and theater, and but it has its own strengths. There's things that you can do in comics and the kinds of stories that you can tell in comics, that there's no other medium that can work as well.
Explain that.
Well, comics are a really intimate experience, and in that respect, they share a lot with the written word. When you're reading a novel, it's basically a one-on-one dialogue between you and the author. And comics have that aspect of them, whereas film is more of a social media where you go out to the movies and it's a shared experience. But because comics are a one-on-one experience, and unlike film, you can take your time, you can rewind, you can like flip back and read slowly or quickly. It's a really direct communication between the author and the viewer. It feels like it's a story that is being told to you, and like you can really get into the author's mind and mind's eye. So it feels like a very private, intimate approach to storytelling, and you can tell stories that can be either epic and grandiose and bombastic, like action stories. And you can also tell stories that are very intimate and private. A lot of stream of consciousness and private thoughts that feel more like reading somebody's mind or reading somebody's diary. And the fact that you can hop between those two really, really well, get like big special effects and just really quiet, introspective storytelling in the same medium makes it really unique. And that's why I think they've kind of exploded the way that they have.
This is a big question, but what does Stan Lee mean to you? Whether that's as an artist and where I would see his influence in your work, or as the human being you've become?
I guess there's two parts about it. I mean, first, as an artist, I think that Stan Lee, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that he has been one of the most influential creators for just culture, both popular culture and just the arts in general, from the 20th century. He started being successful as a comics writer and editor, he was almost in his 40s before he actually started having anything that we'd consider significant professional success beyond just kind of staying alive and making enough money to just keep working and eating. But all of the works that he's become known for, the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, X-Men, Black Panther, Daredevil, all of these things that have now become part of popular culture, those didn't come until he was in his 40s. So he had he was a late bloomer artistically in a way, and that's really inspirational for a lot of artists, just to know that just because you haven't been celebrated by the time you're 25, it doesn't mean that your professional career is over by any means. And in the 50 years since he started having professional success, he had an incredible impact on culture. It's kind of astounding how his creations have become known worldwide. And that's amazing that not only that he had that impact, but that he was alive and able to witness the effect of his work. The artists that have that kind of impact rarely get to see that, because that usually happens posthumously, if it happens at all.
And Hector, you had an internship at Marvel Comics when you were in college. And I wonder if just quickly you can tell us about the Marvel Universe from that vantage point.
It was a sobering experience going to Marvel Comics as a young college student. I was 18 years old. So I went to New York City for a few months, and I worked at Marvel Comics. And
New York City, where Spider-Man takes place.
Right. Yes. And that's another thing about Marvel Comics. Unlike the DC Comics that took place in fictional cities like Metropolis and Gotham City, Marvel Comics took place in the real world. So that was another way in which they were really relatable. The stories were very relatable. So I went to in college. I wanted to go to Marvel Comics for an internship, and in a way, actually, I chose the college that I went to, which is Bennington College in Vermont, because I knew that they had an internship with Marvel Comics. So that was a part of my decision making process applying to colleges, and then going to Marvel Comics. It was a really fascinating place. That all of these creative people were living and working there. My responsibilities were what you would expect from an internship like that. I was making coffee and photocopies, and shipping and receiving. And but it was also fantastic because I would receive the artwork that the artists would send in through FedEx, and sometimes they would have me erasing the pencil lines that hadn't been erased from like the inked pages. But one of the things that was really sobering about it is that sitting in meetings between editors and artists, and just having all this artwork that was coming in daily, realizing that the quality of the artwork, like the editors never paused to kind of like gawk over the artwork and admire it. The fact that the artwork had to be fantastic, that was a given. That was just because it's Tuesday and it's 10:30 in the morning. Like there was no time to like stop and like pat people in the back. It had to be amazing. Otherwise, we wouldn't be there. So that's one of the things that really struck me, is that you've got to be good.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but in a minute, we'll get to your calls about Stan Lee, his comic book creations, and the way they shaped your life on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're paying tribute to Stan Lee this morning. I'm joined by illustrator Hector Casanova. Hello again, Hector.
Hi, Gina.
And Spider-Man collector Mike DeStacy. Hi again, Mike.
Hello.
So now let's bring our listeners in on this conversation at 816-235-2888. We've actually got Will on the line. He runs a comic shop in town, Elite Comics. Hi, Will.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Really good. It's so, kind of a bummer week, but
I'm sorry.
Still, it's kind of good that Stan's getting a little bit more attention.
Well, what does this moment mean to you as a comic book shop owner?
Well, I think it's like it's kind of the end of an era. It's kind of like the pre-Stan and the post-Stan era in comics. I mean, there's nobody else like him. There's no one as big or as important. There's lots of other great creators and lots of people doing a lot of great stuff, but there's no one even in the same realm as Stan Lee in comics.
What was your shop like the day he died?
It was interesting. A lot of people came in to just get something that he had written. I thought there would be more people trying to come in and find something that he had signed or something, an investment book, something old and investy, but it was just people wanting to read a Stan Lee book. A lot of people just buying regular Spider-Man issues, reprints, from the 60s, like a guy came in with his kids and they said they heard and they just wanted to come by and get something Stan Lee to read.
It's interesting because you would think that a lot of the people coming in would have plenty of Stan Lee reading material already.
Oh, there's no such thing as a comic book.
But also,
you might not have enough storage, but you never have.
I can appreciate that. But I guess I'm wondering if there was possibly some other motivation in just the idea that probably if you head to the comic shop, you would find other people also kind of wanting to mark the moment.
Yeah, that might be it, too. You want to be, this is like the comic shop for comic people is kind of their central hub, if something big happened, you want to go there. This is a big thing, Stan Lee passing, but even small things, the new Star Wars trailer comes out, everyone's go to the comic shop so we can all talk about it, and anything in the comic world that you want to be at the comic shop where it's all, well, that's everyone there knows what's important.
Will, I have a question for you about just different... You mentioned that people sort of came in with kids sometimes saying, like, I want to get them these books. Can you talk to me about different generations of Stan Lee fans in particular, people who read within the Marvel universe?
Well, I'm not sure the generations read different stuff. I will. It's really impressive to me how literally everyone knows who Stan Lee is. I mean, little kids know who he is, older people, everyone knows who he is. And I think it's just because he is in everything. He's in all the comics, he's in all the movies, he's in all the video games. I don't think there's any other, he's practically as famous as any comic book character, which is kind of amazing to be a creator and have your fame equal to, Spider-Man and the Hulk and the Avengers and the X-Men. That's kind of amazing.
Well, Will, thank you so much for calling.
Sure.
And now I want to talk to Colin, who is on the line. Colin is with us from Springfield. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So you have quite a relationship with the creations of Stan Lee.
Yeah. I have for the past, I guess, a little over 10 years now, I've been working as a professional comic writer. And I work quite a bit with Marvel. So I've been writing, you know, these characters, these amazing characters that Stan created, like Spider-Man and, you know, the X-Men. And those are characters that that I've, you know, been dealing with for quite a while now.
So what is it that you think Stan Lee has brought to your life through the characters he originated and who you kind of keep alive?
Well, I mean, I think it's safe to say that I wouldn't have the career I have without Stan Lee. I wouldn't be working in comics at all. Not just because he created all of these amazing characters. I mean, not just because I'm writing characters he created, but when I was a kid, it was reading those comics, these characters that Stan created, and reading some of Stan's the comics he wrote himself that really inspired me to be a writer in the first place. He helped me, you know, set me down that path of wanting to tell stories.
What is it? Is there a moment in one of these characters' stories that is sort of like, I don't know, like almost a mantra to you in your life? Do you carry anything that close to you from one of these stories?
Oh, you know, there are bits and pieces that are in all of those character stories that I've picked up over time. It's hard to pinpoint any one, but I mean, if you look at the comic Stan was writing, it was with great power comes great responsibility. That kind of lesson from Spider-Man sticks with you, whether you say it's a mantra or it's the way you live your life. For me, anyway, that's always stuck with me, that idea.
Well, and so many of the conversations about privilege today really boil down to, with great power comes great responsibility.
Absolutely. And I think that those are things that Stan Lee, when he created those characters, he was always thinking about. And really, it's less about a moment in, for me, when it comes to thinking of Stan Lee and what he's done, you know, in society and in entertainment and in comics. It's more about some, you know, things he did, because Stan was this guy who had this amazing creativity and this astounding energy, and he dedicated all of that to just bringing joy to people, and I think that's something that every now and again, when I'm in a crummy mood, and I'm just thinking about how much I don't like people, I have to remember, you know, maybe it'd be better if we were all just a little, if I was just a little more like Stan in that respect, where instead of focusing on those negative things, you know, focus on making people happy a little bit. And I think that's the thing that has stuck with me. So, you know, if there's any one, you know, sort of lesson or thing that has happened over the years that Stan, that when I think about Stan Lee, that's what I think about. It's his dedication to making people happy and bringing joy.
Colin, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Well, so I want to turn back to our in-studio guests, Mike DeStacy. When Colin just talked about Stan Lee being so devoted to just bringing people joy, you know, when you hear about inspiring artists, that's one thing. The act of collecting is just, it is about personal joy, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. There's something in the hunt for me and the camaraderie with other people who, again, just like Will said when he called in about going to the shop and being with other people in that experience. And it's a great, healthy, interesting hobby to have, right?
You know, it's interesting to me that a lot of Stan Lee's most famous characters have something to say about what it means to become a man, not just to be a man, but to become one, and particularly in a culture that doesn't have a lot of rites of passage. When you talk about people who have all read these comics, all finding each other in certain places, it does seem like the reading of Stan Lee comics could be considered a rite of passage in American manhood, which is sort of interesting.
I think one of the things that is really revolutionary about the way that Stan Lee was approaching writing comics in general is that it did very much provide a sense of rite of passage and a way for readers of all kinds to feel integrated into society. And, you know, something that it doesn't often get mentioned, but I think it's very important, is that a lot of the characters that he was writing as flawed characters, they were he was the first writer bringing these kinds of characters to to publication. Like Daredevil was one of his creations, and he was a blind superhero. He was the first disabled superhero that was published. The Black Panther was the first black superhero that had his own story arc and his own book. X-Men, which was about mutants, that was a very thinly veiled metaphor for civil rights. So all of these kids that were growing up in situations where they were just having a hard time integrating to society could read these stories about characters that had a lot in common with them, and how they were not only struggling, having struggles that they could relate to, but they were also contributing to society and were playing heroic roles and had power. And so that allowed, I think, the readers to relate and feel empowered. And that is really huge. He was doing these things in a very low-key, understated way, but it had never been done before. And now that kind of opened the gates to the kind of diversity of representation that we now kind of take for granted, but it really was not, it didn't exist before the 60s.
Yeah, I think there's a certain level of escapism in comics, which is great for people. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, being able to have those long-standing relationships with characters. So, you mentioned earlier about movies and people identifying with that. With comic books, we know Spider-Man's going to be there every single month. And I've got things with, characters in the X-Men that I identify with, and you see struggles that those characters go through. Great constants in your life to help you deal with real things that people deal with, and the characters that grow with you as you grow older.
Hector, I've heard that you were a little surprised by your emotional response to Stan Lee's death.
Yes, I found out while I was at work on Monday, and at first there's just the initial shock that probably everybody can relate to. It's like, oh my God, he's dead. But really quickly, I realized that I wasn't sad. If anything, I was just, I felt so just kind of grateful for the fact that this, just understanding like the scope of his life and his creation and how much he accomplished. He lived a long life. He was 95. I think realistically, his kind of creative output, it's fair to say, that had slowed down dramatically. So I don't think we can say that his best work was laid ahead of him still. He did so much. So I was just kind of taken with a sense of humility and gratitude for and inspiration for, should any of us be so lucky to be able to have that kind of impact on culture and to have that kind of success in career. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it really wasn't until he was, in his 40s that his career even started to take off. And I'm just kind of in my early 40s now. So again, it gives me hope. It's, hang on, that you still might make it.
I think a lot of people would say you've made it, but the point is taken that, it's never too late to make a huge, huge difference.
Right.
Yeah, I'll say that I think the social media experience that day was really, really cool to see how the outpouring from creators that I love and respect and have done great things with interesting characters and how much that Stan meant to them. And that day really became a celebration of his life and who he is and how much he means to people and his characters mean to people.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. Mike DeStacy, this has been great.
Thank you so much.
Hector Casanova, thank you.
Thank you, Gina. It's been a pleasure.
Share any and all documentation of your Stan Lee fandom on Twitter. We would love to see it. I should maybe say I would love to see it. At KCURCST, I'm Gina Kaufman, and there's more to come for today's show, so stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to talk about Sherlock Holmes. This year marks the 55th anniversary of the Great Alkali Plainsman of Kansas City. That is a Sherlock Holmes fan club, but so much more than that. It is the Midwest's connection to an international organization promoting the ongoing scholarship of Sherlock Holmes. And although this is the group's 55th anniversary, it had actually disbanded for a little while, and we're about to meet the guy who revived it. Scott Turner, good morning.
Hi.
So tell me the story of coming to Kansas City and reviving what we'll call for now a Sherlock Holmes fan club, although, as I've acknowledged, it is more.
So I came here about a year ago from Pennsylvania, and I was involved with a couple of Sherlock Holmes groups there and started one in Danville, which is where I was from. And when I, of course, came here to Kansas City, the first thing you do is to look up and see if there's a local Sherlock Holmes group.
And of course you do.
Of course. And the one here was the Great Alkali Plainsman, and I discovered through some folks in St. Louis that it had fallen by the wayside several years ago. And I met Dan, and he was interested in restarting a group in Kansas City, and we decided, let's just restart the group in Kansas City.
Okay, we're going to meet Dan in a minute, but I have to ask you about this. So you're talking about, like, you've lived other places, been involved in other Sherlock Holmes groups. This is the first thing you do when you move to a new city is look up, like, hey, where's the Sherlock Holmes group?
Of course.
What is a Sherlock Holmes group? Like, what do you do?
So generally what we do is pick one of the short stories or one of the novels.
By Arthur Conan Doyle.
That's right. And we have a discussion about it, have a quiz.
A quiz?
A quiz, yeah.
Who writes the quiz?
It depends. Sometimes I do, and whoever wins the quiz from the previous month, sometimes they do. But that's just ensures that everyone reads the story.
This is an extracurricular activity for adults with quizzes.
That's right.
What do you like about it?
I have always been a fan of detective fiction and mysteries, and like the Victorian era, and Sherlock Holmes is, of course, one of the most important, detectives in fiction. I like the period. I just think it's interesting. I was introduced to Sherlock Holmes back when I was a teenager and read all the stories then and have kind of stayed with it.
We heard just earlier in the show from people who grew up reading comic books and the way that carried forward into their lives as adults and really has become a part of who they are. What is it about Sherlock Holmes that had, it sounds like, a very similar kind of impact on you?
Mm-hmm. Dan and I were talking about this just a little bit ago. The time period is very elegant. Sherlock Holmes is an interesting character. He's very quirky. And as Dan was saying, it's cool to be smart.
Well, we're going to get to Dan, but set for me the stage of your life when you're reading this and why it was maybe that elegant time period appealed to you in that way.
I'd read science fiction and other types of books, but a lot of these short stories are very accessible. I mean, they're readable within an hour or two, and you get a really interesting story with some interesting characters, and it kind of resolves by the end of the story, and then you can move on.
And that was different from real life, or?
it was an escape,
Well, so let's talk to Dan. Dan Payton is also a member of the group, and he revived it with Scott. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
So what's your take on this? Like, how Sherlock Holmes became a character and how Arthur Conan Doyle became an author who had this kind of role in not just your life, but other people's lives, too.
Well, for me, I grew up in very rural Kentucky, and so a bookmobile, a librarian. I finished all the Encyclopedia Brown books, and I was 8 years old. And I asked the librarian, what's next? And she said, well, there's this gentleman called Sherlock Holmes. And that kind of started my journey.
What do you think that you liked about Sherlock Holmes?
To me, a lot of the heroes of literature that you would read, Sherlock Holmes, as we talked about, it made it cool to be smart. The idea of using your brains to solve a problem. And for me, it's always been about that relationship between Sherlock Holmes and John Watson.
Tell me more about that.
Well, in Victorian Edwardian time, for two men to rely on each other so completely and to both bring something to the partnership, to me, it was just fascinating. And Sherlock Holmes, quite frankly, is difficult. And John Watson has the patience of Job. And so it's fascinating to watch their strengths and weaknesses complement one another. They would not have been effective without one another.
So tell me the story of starting this thing back up. Were you surprised when someone reached out to you wanting to start the Alkali Plainsmen back up?
Surprised? No. I was very happy about it, though. I had been, quote-unquote, poaching from other societies. I've been to Minneapolis, Dayton, Ohio, Baltimore, St. Louis.
Other Sherlock Holmes societies.
Yes, I have gone to other Sherlock Holmes societies. We actually have some conferences that we hold, different societies. So to revive the great Alkali Plainsman was just a thrill. It's as you mentioned, it's got a history back to 1963, and so we're passionate about this, obviously. So it's great to find our people.
What do you do other than have quizzes and reading assignments?
Our last meeting, we actually had an author from Denver, Colorado, Darlene Seipzer, who came in and spoke about her Sherlockian works that she's done. She does pastiches. So pastiche being a Sherlock Holmes novel written in the vein of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's works. And so she came and spoke to our group. And then last night, actually, I spoke to a living history group called Questers. And they're based out of Olathe, and they're dedicated to the preservation of history. So it fit right within that.
This is such a widespread thing that I've never heard about before, honestly. Like, I didn't realize that there was such a culture of Sherlock Holmes devotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, people are very passionate about it, and you find like-minded folks and explore the stories and learn a little bit every time.
And I understand that some of the original members of the group you were able to track down when you found out that there was this history of a group here in Kansas City, but that it had been sort of inactive.
Yeah. I mean, so the group was started back in 1963, as Dan was saying, by Bob Wheeler and his father, Ernest, and by John Altman. And it had been active for, you know, decades, and then kind of, I guess, ceased. The interest kind of went away, I suppose. And so we're very excited to get the group up and running. And Bob and John are both involved, and we've reached out to them, as well as John Lellenberger, who is one of the leaders of the group in the past. So we do have that sense of history.
What were their responses when you reached out to them? And have you learned anything from them, just given their long history with Sherlock Holmes? They're really a long relationship with the character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're much more expert at it than I am. But they're very excited about restarting the group and being involved with it. And, you know, we get all these great stories every time we get together from what was going on in the past.
Dan, talk to me more about these original group members.
They're brilliant. John Altman and Bob Wheeler, it's great to talk to them and to learn the history of what they've done. You know, we're fortunate to be one of about 425 active Sherlockian societies in the United States. And so for us to find the core group here was just very exciting.
What is it, do you think, that like the typical person who doesn't participate in one of these groups might not get?
The reader today doesn't know what a gasogene in Victorian time was, what a hansom cab was, what a dog cart was. So that little slice of Victorian Edwardian life that you can, the reader of the day, the reader of 1887, that was just life. But for for us, it's not just a love of literature, it's a love of history.
Are there, I mean, when you explore this time period, do you do it through things other than literature? Is it a more general interest than that, or is it really strictly through the lens of Sherlock Holmes?
Well, speaking for me, I have way too many books at my house, and I have books on, as I'm sure Scott does as well, on Victorian life in general. So it definitely bleeds over into that as well.
What do you think it is about the era that interests you? For Scott, it was the elegance.
I don't know. That's a toughie. For me, I think it has to be some of that. The image of the gaslight, to hear the clop, clop, clop of the horses on the street outside, to know that the railway stations in Victorian London, that was such an important part of life. It was just a different way of living.
Jump in here.
I agree. I mean, it's like being in an entirely different world, different country, different time. Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you read a Sherlock Holmes book?
Yeah, it was probably in middle school or so. And I just took, I think it was over the summer, and I picked it up and just read all the stories and all the novels.
I'm curious more about the, like, I don't know, that this is an international phenomenon, and that, in fact, the great Alkali Plainsmen of Kansas City is part of this group that started in Britain in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about this international organization?
Well, the Baker Street Irregulars started in 1934, and that was really the start of this, and they started in New York City. And so that kind of created the concept of getting around and having a good time talking about Sherlock Holmes. You know, the old joke, and Scott helped me with this so I don't mess this up, of a good Sherlockian society is that all you need is two people in a bottle. And if necessary, you can do without the other person.
That was John Bennett Shaw.
Have you been to one of these in Britain?
No, but I did go to London in 2004 and drug my lovely wife, Kim, all over London and said, hey, we've got to go to this spot outside this theater because this is where they stood in the Sign of Four. And she always has to remind me, you do know they're not real, right? And I said, well,
that's open to debate.
So they do feel real to you, like people you've had decades-long relationships with.
I'm celebrating my 40th year about being passionate about this. So this is definitely part of, if you create labels on yourself, one of my labels is I'm a Sherlockian.
Is that part of your, like, identity too, Scott?
Sure. I mean, I'm a big Star Wars fan, I'm a physician, but I'm also a Sherlockian, and I have been for many, many years.
How do you find, being a physician, that's so demanding, how do you find time to be a Sherlockian too? To take reading quizzes and...
it's enjoyable, it's not work.
Not work. Well, I'm glad that it's not work for you, and it sounds like you guys really have quite a community going. So our time is up, but Dan Payton, Scott Turner, thank you both so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Our guests are members of the Great Alkali Plainsmen of Kansas City, a Sherlock Holmes fan club that's celebrating 55 years in Kansas City. And that's a wrap. So you can hear anything from today's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with local comic book creators and collectors about the passing of Stan Lee and his influence on their work. We're asking you to send us photographic documentation of your love of Stan Lee's characters from the Marvel Comics universe. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, the musician known as Sauce, we will get to know him and his sound tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.